From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. There was more unrest last night in Portland, Oregon, which is now the center of a showdown between protesters and law enforcement.
The protests have been going on since the killing of George Floyd, and at times they've gotten violent. The Trump administration sent in what some are calling secret police, it says, to protect a federal courthouse. Meanwhile, the White House sent federal law enforcement officers into other cities, including Chicago and Albuquerque this week in what's called Operation Legend, it says, to reduce violent crime. That has also been criticized. Joining us now is Janet Napolitano, former Secretary of Homeland Security under President Obama, now the outgoing president of the University of California. Welcome.
Thank you. How are you?
I'm doing fine. So there are two kinds of federal intervention happening now in cities. The move into Chicago and Albuquerque is something called Operation Legend, which started in Kansas City earlier this month. The acting Secretary of Homeland Security said this is not related to the deployment in Portland. Do you see all of this as standard cooperation with local agencies to prosecute federal crimes or something more?
I think time will tell. We don't really know. If what the feds are doing is simply adding more federal officers to existing task forces that have a defined mission, that's one thing. It's another thing altogether to send in federal agents not connected with any kind of task force over the objection of local police chiefs, mayors, and so forth, to do what's been happening in Portland.
Another former Secretary of Homeland Security, Tom Ridge, a Republican, said that the Department of Homeland Security was established to protect America from the ever-present threat of global terrorism. It was not established to be the president's personal militia. Is that how you see what's going on right now as well?
Certainly, with respect to Portland, I totally agree with Secretary Ridge. Yeah, totally inappropriate use of DHS.
So you think that they are different, though? You say that about Portland, but maybe not Operation Legend in these other cities.
Right. And, you know, we have to wait and see, whether, in fact, how Operation Legend was represented is, in fact, how it's being carried out. But if it's simply, beefing up existing federal local task forces, and they have a defined need and defined mission in those communities, that's a different kind of operation.
Well, what about Portland? Many of the agents there are from the U.S. Marshals Special Operations Group, which is part of Customs and Border Protection. What do you think of the idea of using Border Patrol agents to respond to protests?
As I said, I think it's totally inappropriate. And you have to ask, what are those border agents not doing in order to be redeployed to Portland? Last time I looked, Portland is not on the border. The Department of Homeland Security is not the president's militia force. It's not intended to be that. It's not designed to be that. And we've seen in Portland how injecting them into the community has only inflamed the situation there. It hasn't helped calm things down.
Well, how much do you think politics is driving the administration's decision to do this now, just as the president's reelection campaign seeks to brand him as the law and order candidate?
Oh, I think you can see pretty clearly that this is part of the law and order positioning of President Trump. It's so obvious. And that just adds to the inappropriateness of what's going on in Portland.
I want to ask you a question about another role. You obviously were the Secretary of Homeland Security, but you are now the outgoing president of the University of California system. Your term ends on August 1st. All the U of C campuses are going to be starting online this fall. Do you think that in the spring that could happen as well in California?
You know, we sincerely hope not, but we're planning through that scenario. And, unless there is a vaccine, it is a good possibility that the kind of remote or online learning that we will be using for the beginning of the fall will continue into the spring. It really depends on what the situation is and how we can safely reopen the campuses.
Do you think that the students are going to get as good of an education with an online learning situation than they would in person?
They'll get a different kind of education, but they'll get a very, very good education. They did last spring when we had to immediately convert to online, and we've spent the summer only beefing up our online content and capabilities. It will be a very good education. It will be a UC-level education.
You were the Democratic governor of Arizona, a state that has only gone blue once in a presidential election since 1972. That was in 1996 for Bill Clinton's reelection. But the polls right now show Joe Biden ahead pretty consistently in Arizona. Why do you think that is? Has Arizona changed that quickly over the last few years?
Yeah, I think Arizona has changed and is changing. But I think that while it looks very good for Joe Biden there right now, he has to, in a way, build up his lead because the state tends to settle on the Republican side of things. So you've got to have that buffer there.
Mm-hmm. And you don't see that yet.
It's right about there. Yeah, I very much believe Arizona is in play for this fall.
That is Janet Napolitano, the former governor of Arizona, former secretary of Homeland Security, and now outgoing president of the University of California. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
The Cleveland Indians opened their truncated MLB regular season tonight, hosting the Kansas City Royals. And after the NFL team in Washington, D.C. announced that it would change its nickname, Cleveland released a statement saying the team would engage the community and its stakeholders to determine the best path forward for their brand. As Glenn Forbes from WCPN IdeaStream reports, that's a long way of saying the team won't have its current name for long.
John Adams has been banging the drum, literally, for the Cleveland Indians, lugging his 26-inch bass drum to home games for 47 years now. A trained drummer who helped start the Cleveland Blues Society, Adams says this was never a tribal war drum to play off the team name, but an extension of his youth when he would bang empty wooden chairs at the game to cause a ruckus. Regardless of intent, Adams has been the target of protesters who have demonstrated against the Indians' name on opening day.
He says that's a sacred instrument. And it's only played, it's a spiritual thing. And now knowing this, he says, are you going to still play the drum? And I said, well, with my people, it means calling everybody together and one heartbeat.
Adam says he knows that Native American was from out of town because he says he's spoken with leaders of the local protests and most have no problem with him or his drum. One of the groups is the Cleveland American Indian Movement. Sundance is their executive director and part of the Muskogee tribe.
It took a very public death of a person of color and weeks of civil disobedience before they would even consider maybe changing the name. That in and of itself is offensive.
Terry Pluto has covered Cleveland for 40 years. He researched the team's name for his book, Our Tribe, and says Cleveland tried to capitalize on momentum and popularity of baseball's 1914 Boston Braves, leading to the Indians' name. The team officially retired the problematic gap-toothed Chief Wahoo logo before last season, which Pluto says was more offensive to Native Americans he's spoken to than the team name. At the time Wahoo was retired, Pluto says there were no plans to change the team's name, but the death of George Floyd, the ensuing protests, and FedEx's support of a name change for Washington's NFL team makes the Indians' announcement less of a surprise.
The Indians do not want their top sponsors, Progressive and Sherwin-Williams and the rest, to get a lot of pressure from special interest groups and others.
But this isn't simply a matter of changing a name.
One member of the organization said to me, we can't just throw a name out there and say 3 years from now, we got to change it. This is a multi-million dollar trademark, changing a brand, all kinds of stuff. This next few months, they'll kind of examine, they'll meet with some Native American groups, and then at some point, they'll announce they're going to change the name.
Pluto believes 2021 will be a farewell tour of sorts for the Indians' name, which will also give the club time to reconfigure the ballpark around a new brand. Since 2013, manager Terry Francona has been the voice of the organization. He said he knows the team isn't trying to be disrespectful and feels the same way now.
But I don't think that's a good enough answer today. Even at my age, you don't want to be too old to learn or to realize that maybe I've been ignorant of some things.
Suggestions to replace Indians include former team names like the Spiders and Crusaders, cliched references to rock and roll, and a Lake Erie-inspired fish. The Cleveland Carps? Muskegee tribe member Sundance knows what name he wants.
We would prefer that the new name not reference anything with indigenous people, not our cultures, not our religions, not our cultural items, period.
Terry Pluto estimates that of the well over 300 emails he's received, the vast majority don't believe the name is offensive, but they're tired of the culture war and are ready to move forward. Drummer John Adams, the Indians' most recognizable fan, likes another suggestion that's gaining traction, the Cleveland Drummers.
Yeah, and then a cartoon caricature of me. I'd love it. I would love it. I would be honored.
For Here and Now, I'm Glenn Forbes in Cleveland.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Bard College at Simon's Rock, where students who crave intellectual freedom can begin college after the 10th or 11th grade. Bard College at Simon's Rock unleashes students' curiosity through a rigorous liberal arts and sciences curriculum and puts them on track toward completing a bachelor's degree 1 or 2 years early. Now accepting applications for fall 2020. simons-rock.edu/now. Where independent minds get their start.
Even if Congress re-ups the $600 weekly CARES Act benefit that is set to end next week, many of you have shared with us that either you can't get through to your state unemployment office to file for benefits, or you still haven't received relief. That's the case for Betsy Burke and her family in Lansdowne, Pennsylvania. Betsy's husband supports the family through his job as a mechanical engineer. He was first furloughed in April, then laid off in June.
So my question is, what do we do? If you call the unemployment office, you get a busy signal. Like, they don't even put you on hold. I mean, at this point, we've contacted our politicians. There are so many layers to what's going on. And to have your government drag its feet on its willingness to help people financially is just insult to injury.
Joining us now is Andrew Stettner, a senior fellow at the progressive nonpartisan think tank, the Century Foundation. Andrew, welcome back.
Glad to be back.
So first, to Betsy's question, what options do people like her have to get answers about their unemployment claims if their state won't even answer them?
You know, it's been an excruciating and very frustrating and opaque process. You know, she's doing the right things. Absolutely, it's persistence. It's reaching out to others in the similar situation and figuring out how they're getting answers and continuing to press, you know, multiple layers, including your state representatives and sometimes even the media. You know, people's claims are being stopped for a variety of reasons, including fraud protection activities. And it's not been clear to people how they need to clear their claim and get it going again. So I really do know it's very frustrating.
Yeah, the unemployment benefit process can be convoluted even when we aren't in a pandemic. But one of the connecting issues we keep hearing is that basically people feel ignored. So Michael Smith of Marietta, Georgia, writes that he's helping a friend apply for unemployment, and they have had several emails returned as undeliverable, fax machines aren't working, and local help offices are basically closed. So he wonders why states don't already have a workable contingent plan to handle a surge in unemployment claims. Can you give us a sense of why, after months, states still haven't been able to figure this out yet?
You know, we went into this situation really ignoring this program, having very antiquated systems. And unfortunately, you know, too much of an attitude of our goal in building our applications is to prevent fraud and not necessarily to help our customers. And I will say that those states that have a customer service orientation and think of their job first as paying workers who are unemployed, states like Rhode Island, you know, and increasingly Michigan, you know, they're doing a better job. No state is having it easy. But those states that have a customer service orientation, I think, are doing a better job. And it's really incumbent on the states to step back and approach things differently. They need to move from, you know, more of people frustrated and reaching out to them, they can't get answers, to being proactive. And let's use technology in creative ways. You know, work with technology companies. A lot of them are volunteering to help or giving deep discounts. Create an app to capture the information that's needed. It may be a temporary app, and maybe becomes part of our program going forward. But we can't just sit back in the way that we're doing it. States have obviously been working incredibly hard. They've hired new people. They've expanded their hours. But they also need to work smarter than they're working so far.
We have another question from a listener who also has not been paid for her unemployment claim. Let's listen.
My name is Latoya Wright. I live in Fort Knox, Kentucky, and I work as a housekeeper at a hotel. I was laid off in March. My last day working was March 13th, and I think I filed for unemployment on the 22nd. I haven't received any unemployment pay at all, and not the CARES Act either. I would like to know if I will get back pay. My case hasn't been fully processed. I would like to know when and how long it takes to get back pay, because I live with family. They have been taking care of me and my two children, and we have just been kind of scraping by.
A lot of listeners have been sharing the same story with us. What can you tell us about unemployment back pay and how that works?
So when you first apply for benefits, you usually are given a logon, and even if you don't get paid, usually are afforded the opportunity to certify that you are continuing to be unemployed. So especially for those individuals who have followed that advice, and it's pretty confusing, right? I'm not getting paid, but I'm still going to call in this number or go online and certify that I'm still unemployed each and every week. Certainly for those individuals who have followed that advice, when you are found eligible, you should get your back pay pretty quickly. There have been some states that have proactively reached out to those individuals who were waiting and didn't certify and allow them to, you know, fill out a form online to show that they were indeed unemployed during those weeks. But the bottom line is that you should get back pay, and you should get back pay, you know, pretty soon to when you get your payment once you're processed, especially if you have followed those directions and have certified each and every week that you're unemployed.
I want to turn the table around to you, Andrew. What questions might you possibly have for all of the people out there who are unemployed, and what do you want to know from them to help maybe in assessing and getting a better understanding so that states could do better?
Well, I think I certainly am, you know, wanting to know, you know, how they're managing the stress and how they're getting by. Are they getting information, you know, about other resources that they, you know, can help subside, you know, during this period? I'm looking for, you know, them to say, you know, what are the types of customer service features that would make the biggest difference to me? Would it make a bigger difference so I could log on and look at this the same way I look at, you know, other websites like my credit card or my bank account? Do I want to be able to use texting? You know, I am looking for that user feedback. We've called on the states to think of unemployed workers as their customers and test out their technology, you know, with regular people, you know, as users. You know, we've been studying this for the last 18 months, even before the pandemic, and we really didn't find, except for one or two states, any states, even with tens of millions of dollars in major technology investments, using a professional user testing company to test it out, you know, with regular people and not just test it on their staff. So we really need this customer service orientation. So I would want to show them the technology and say, where have you been confused? Where could this be easier? We need to design our systems in a human manner.
Andrew Stettner is a senior fellow at the nonpartisan think tank, the Century Foundation. Andrew, thank you so much.
Thank you, Tanya.
Another form of federal relief that's also expiring is the evictions moratorium, which is set to end tomorrow. Housing advocates have long warned of an impending evictions crisis. And as more federal and state protections expire, that reality may be drawing closer. For more, we're joined by Stacy Butler, University of Arizona law professor and director of the Innovation for Justice program. And she's been working with a team tracking housing issues during this pandemic. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
First, can you remind us exactly what kinds of properties were covered by this federal eviction moratorium and how many people were protected under it?
The CARES Act protections prevent the filing of an eviction action against rental property secured by a federally backed mortgage loan. So those protections have applied to approximately 30% of the rental properties in the United States.
You've been looking at the downstream costs associated with evictions, like emergency shelter and medical care, for instance. What are you expecting the cost to be nationwide?
So researchers are now projecting that between 17 and 28 million renter households are at risk of eviction when eviction moratoriums expire. The Innovation for Justice program hosts an online cost of eviction calculator that estimates some of the downstream social costs of eviction. If we conservatively estimate 17 million renter households will be at risk of eviction by the end of this year, if each of those households is evicted, the United States will spend over $200 billion on eviction-related social costs such as emergency shelter, medical care, child welfare, and juvenile delinquency. If we consider the higher estimate of 28 million households at risk of eviction, that cost could exceed $315 billion.
Some states, including Arizona, continue to have eviction moratoriums in place, and many localities are creating rental relief funds, we've been seeing. What's next in terms of possible solutions to address what many are calling, I mean, what you've laid out for us as an impending evictions crisis?
Most urgently, eviction moratoriums need to be extended until the backlogs in the delivery of rental assistance and unemployment assistance are resolved and financial relief measures are extended. 17 million households at risk of eviction could be helped with an estimated $144 billion in rent relief, and that's half of the estimated $315 billion community cost of mass evictions. It's the humane thing to do. Immediate rent relief will keep people housed during a pandemic. And rent relief doesn't just help tenants. Rent pays for mortgages, so property owners are at risk of foreclosure without rent relief. And rent also pays for property taxes, which supports community services, schools, and infrastructure. So if the rental market collapses, we will all feel that impact. So we need to work to prevent eviction because housing is a human right. But if that doesn't motivate, decision makers need to understand that rent relief is far less expensive than the unprecedented and pervasive societal costs of the eviction tidal wave that is coming.
That's Stacey Butler, University of Arizona law professor and director of the Innovation for Justice program. Thank you, Stacey.
Thank you for having me.
The White House today urged China not to engage in a tit-for-tat retaliation. Washington was responding to Beijing's order to close the American consulate in Chengdu. That followed the U.S. order for China to close its consulate in Houston earlier this week. Joining us now is Robert Daly, director of the Kissinger Institute at the Wilson Center. He's a former American diplomat who served in Beijing. Robert Daly, what is your reaction to this apparent retaliation by China and to the overall back and forth between the U.S. and China right now?
China's announcement that it was going to shutter the American consulate in Chengdu, I think, was predictable. And from China's point of view, it was a proportionate response to America's closing China's consulate in Houston. Hardliners in China had wanted to close America's consulate in Hong Kong, which would have been a much bigger step. The question now is whether the United States will close other Chinese consulates, quite possibly the one in San Francisco. And as to where this goes, if we keep closing missions, we're heading toward the dissolution of U.S.-China formal diplomatic relations.
And what are the consequences of that? Are you worried about a military conflict if that happens?
Well, we already have a nascent arms race between the United States and China. If we no longer have diplomatic relations, there will be a high degree of mutual alienation. Hostility to the other country will become an organizing principle in both China and the United States. We're going to see the resurrection of mutual assured destruction. And the new arms race, unlike the previous one, would comprise not only nuclear weapons, but cyber weapons and the weaponization of outer space as well. So this is an extremely dangerous move, which is going to be harmful not just in the U.S. and China, but around the world, in all the other nations that are deeply integrated with both countries.
Do you think the Trump administration has a strategy?
A full strategy has not yet appeared. They have been somewhat more strategic over the past few months, but they have not yet been effectively strategic. It isn't really clear what state of relations between the United States and China they are aiming at. They seem to be testing China to see how much confrontation and offensive language they can get away with, but it's not clear what the end game is. Most worrisomely, the Trump administration has not leveled with the American people about what costs will be incurred, what sacrifices will have to be made if we're involved in a long-term global competition with the most populous nation on earth that will soon also be the wealthiest. This is going to entail real sacrifice and real changes in the United States, you know, throughout our society. And they haven't leveled on that. They're merely implying a willingness to throw down with China without clarity about what that might cost.
Do you think that those costs would be worth it?
Well, this depends on what is at stake. I think that the administration is correct. And Secretary of State Pompeo yesterday said that the Chinese Communist Party, through its foreign policy, wants to legitimize China's illiberal practices worldwide. They do want a world that is welcoming to, receptive to, a Chinese Communist Party that is increasingly repressive at home and aggressive internationally. A Chinese Communist Party that within China has moved from reform towards something like techno-totalitarianism. A Chinese Communist Party that wishes to silence free media and civil society worldwide. So there is a real threat from China, and it needs to be countered. It's the overstatement of that threat, the lack of proportionality that could raise the costs of competition between the United States and China.
That's Robert Daly, director of the Kissinger Institute at the Wilson Center. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
This week marked 6 months since the CDC confirmed the first case of COVID-19 in the U.S., Now there have been more than 4 million. And while we know a lot more today about the virus than we did then, there is still a lot we don't know. So let's get answers to some of our questions from Dr. Tom Inglesby, director of the Center for Health Security of the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Dr. Inglesby, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, just big picture, as you look at the situation right now and the places where we're seeing new spikes in cases, how bad do you think this pandemic is going to get in the U.S., and are we still going to be dealing with this virus in a major way into next year?
Yeah, I mean, at this point, we are in a bad place with this pandemic in the U.S. It's pretty clear that in the last month in particular, things have really moved in the wrong direction in many states around the country, and we're going to be dealing with this virus for quite some time. And so we do have to find a way to live with it and to better control it. And right now, we're not doing a very good job of that.
Well, what would you say is the way that we could better control it? Obviously, there's been a change in strategy when it comes to masks, especially from the president of the United States, being more willing to say to people they should wear masks when they can't be socially distant from each other. But what would your recommendation be about how to better control this virus?
As you were saying, we need to start with the basics. Universal masking when people are in public places, social distancing at an individual level, not being close to people without a mask who are outside your family, and avoiding large gatherings. But in places where the disease is really accelerating around the country, we're going to obviously need to do more than that. And I think reclosure of some of the higher risk activities is going to be important. So reclosure of bars and large indoor restaurants and religious facilities where lots of people are close together. Those are going to be important control measures. Hopefully that will be enough in many places, but in places that have already done those things and the disease is still accelerating, then I think those places are going to need to consider going back to the measures that worked in March, temporary stay at home until things get under better control in their communities.
Is there a way to keep one state with a bad outbreak from reinfecting another aside from banning interstate travel? And do you think that's something that we should be talking about?
I don't think banning interstate travel is a good approach for the country because too much of what we do requires movement around the country. And that's the movement of goods and services and people taking care of their families and needing to be able to move to someplace when someone gets sick or there's another kind of family reason for that. So I don't think that's worth it. But I do think that states now have a clear interest in, if you are coming from a state where there's been lots of disease, then having a very low threshold for getting tested when you're coming into a state that has very little disease. I think those things are going to be worked out state by state, but I don't think we should stop movement around the country. I think all states should be acting in the same way, which is we need to reduce social interaction to a lower level so we can get control of this in the ways that other countries in the world have been doing.
Let's talk about testing, because across the country, many people are waiting more than a week to get their test results. Why is it taking so long still for people to get the results of their tests?
Yeah, well, I think one of the things that's happened in the last month is that because of the surge in disease in many states around the country, the testing has also gone way up. And so the pressure on laboratories has gone up, and there now become shortages in the reagents that are used and the swabs that are used. But overall, there's a variety of reasons that are contributing to these testing delays. Some of them is just backlog. Some of them are shortages. Some of it is the time between a test is done and mailed out to a lab somewhere else in the country that might be in the middle of another hotspot. But we absolutely have to get the time down. 2 days is really the most we should have in terms of the time between a test is done and the result is given back to the patient and the public health department.
Well, there's another issue with testing I want to ask you about, because last week we spoke with a woman in Georgia who talked about her experience with COVID-19. She had a known exposure and symptoms. But when she and a coworker took two tests, one at LabCorp and one self-administered test at CVS, they came back negative. Let's listen.
And then we ended up testing again that next week. Her symptoms increased. And by the way, she didn't quarantine because she got a negative test result. Mm-hmm. But I did quarantine because I knew what I was feeling.
And it came back positive.
Yeah. And that's where the positive test results came from.
So that's concerning. Do we know how long it takes after infection, even after symptoms, for the test to reflect that somebody is positive?
It depends on the person, unfortunately. We don't really have people vary. And within an individual, a test could be negative on day 1, 2, 3, 4, and then positive on day 5. So there's no standard universal number when the test becomes positive. It could become positive anytime between 0 and 14 days.
So how do you deal with that, though? Because then you'd have a lot of people walking around saying, oh, well, I don't have it, but they actually do, and they're spreading it.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, that is a limitation of the test. It's not a perfect test. It only tells you that you are negative that day. And we know that there also are false positives and false negatives for these tests, but they're the best that we have. If people continue to feel unwell and their doctor thinks that they have it, or they believe they have been exposed or think they may have COVID, then they should go back and get a second test.
Let me ask you, do you think that it is at this point relatively safe to be outside as opposed to inside? A lot of people are dining outside, maybe they're distanced from the next table over, but they're still dining outside without a mask on at the table. Is that safe?
It is far safer to be outside than to be inside in a restaurant. It's not possible to say something is completely safe. There are circumstances where you could have a transmission in an outdoor location, but we know from the studies that have gone on so far that outdoor transmission is much less likely than indoor transmission. Ventilation helps. The fact that you're not in a closed space where the air is not moving, those are all risks. So the fact that you're outside, ventilation is there, decreases the risk substantially. But unfortunately, like a lot of things with COVID, we can't say it's completely safe. It's just much safer.
And what about touching surfaces? I have to say, I don't worry that much anymore about a package coming from UPS or FedEx that's going to transmit coronavirus to me.
Yeah, I think it's still important to have really good hand hygiene. And for high touch surfaces, they should be cleaned in buildings or in places where people are interacting. But there hasn't been a lot of evidence that people have been catching this disease by touching packages or things that come into their house. We do believe touching surfaces that are contaminated is a potential means of transmission, but it's far, far, far less important than respiratory transmission at close range.
We saw Dr. Birx, a key member of the coronavirus task force, say that it's not clear, still an open question, how much children under 10 will spread the illness. Obviously, this is a big worry because of schools, which are about to reopen in some places. What do you think about that, about whether kids are going to transmit it to the others and to adults?
We don't have as much evidence as we need to make these really high consequence decisions. I think all the things that schools are doing to try and mitigate the risk with masks and distancing and avoiding large assemblies and where possible cohorting kids into smaller groups, those are all going to be really important to try and lower the risk for schools that do open.
Do you think that it is likely there will be a vaccine this year?
I think it is possible that there will be a safe and effective vaccine developed this year, perhaps more than one. But I also think that there are many ways that that will not happen. It all depends on the outcomes of a number of studies that are coming up over the summer and in the fall. But I think it's possible or possible early in 2021. And it'll be really important at that point to scale up the manufacture of this vaccine, because just because we have a vaccine doesn't mean we're going to be able to get it to people. That's going to require a whole lot of work to manufacture it at large scale so that we can begin to move it to people who need it the most.
That is Dr. Tom Inglesby, the director of the Center for Health Security at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Dr. Inglesby, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Jeremy.
The numbers are staggering. This week, 500 women at the Federal Medical Center Carswell in Fort Worth, Texas, tested positive for the coronavirus. This after months of complaints about unsafe conditions from inmates. And as of last week, the Stiles unit in Beaumont and the Caulfield unit in East Texas had more than 1,400 infections between them. Thousands of prisoners in Texas eligible for parole are also finding themselves in limbo, being told they can't leave because of the pandemic. Texas Tribune reporter Jolie McCullough has been writing about this crisis, and she joins us from Austin. Jolie, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So before we get to the parole situation, describe for us the situation in Texas. What are inmates experiencing in these prisons?
Basically, when you talk to inmates, when I've been talking to inmates through letters or I've been talking to their loved ones, people are desperate and they're terrified right now because the coronavirus has spread like wildfire through a lot of these prisons. There's more than 100 prisons run by the state of Texas, and almost all of them have had at least some level of infection. And some of them have had explosions, like you've mentioned. And there's another one right now, the Polunsky unit, which is actually where Texas's death row inmates are housed, has about 750 active cases.
Is there any sense of why prisons are so hard hit? Is it a lack of testing or sanitary conditions inside of the facilities? What is it?
Texas actually has been doing a lot of testing, about 150,000 tests on inmates, and they found more than, 13,600 of them have come back positive. But there's a lawsuit right now in federal court actually going on more about the conditions, how they're being protected on the inside. They fight for things like hand sanitizer. The Texas Department of Criminal Justice does not want to give inmates hand sanitizer because they think they'll drink it or they will use it to start fires. Inmates on the inside are saying, officers aren't protecting them. They're not wearing masks as they should be. They're not giving enough cleaning supplies. They're having to go to the showers altogether. And they're saying that there's just not enough being done to protect them.
You write today about the parole situation, that about 15,000 prisoners have been approved but not yet released. What's going on there? Why can't they leave?
Currently, there's about 12% of the state prison population that have been told, hey, you're going to be able to go home, and they're still behind bars. Any unit that's on lockdown, which means anytime there's an active infection in the unit goes on lockdown. Inmates aren't able to leave their cubicles or their cells largely. And also that means there's no one coming in or out. And that means no one's being let out. Another thing that keeps people from parole is they've been told, yes, you're able to leave, but you have to complete this in-prison programming first, whether it's, you know, on life skills or on some sort of drug and substance abuse issues. But they are only at certain units, and a lot of them can't go to those units right now because either they're at a prison that has an infection or the one that has the program has infections.
How is the Texas Department of Criminal Justice responding to these complaints? What are they telling you?
Yeah, so they've told me, you know, they're trying as hard as they can to keep releases going as much as they can, but they don't release anyone from lockdown units, and they also are having issues in terms of dealing with the parole board. They've repeatedly said since March they haven't changed the way that they are determining release decisions in this pandemic.
What is Governor Greg Abbott saying about all of this? I mean, we're hearing in other places, for instance, Orange County, California, released another 176 people yesterday. Their total for early release is now about 10,000 people.
Governor Greg Abbott said in March that releasing, quote, dangerous criminals to the streets is not the solution to protecting inmates in prisons. And he has really remained silent on the issue ever since then.
Yeah. March is a long time from where when we're thinking about the progression of this pandemic. I mean, March seems like a world away.
Right. I've asked, I know other reporters have asked, like, has anything changed on this? I also continuously asked the parole board, and I haven't heard from the governor. Like, a spokesperson has not responded to repeated questions on the issue.
Mm-hmm. You spoke to a family of a 73-year-old who died in prison after being paroled. Who was he, and what did his family tell you?
His name was Theodore Cruz. His nickname is Seago, according to his daughter. They noticed a significant weight loss here in May, and he was telling her that, I'm not able to eat enough in here because they're on lockdown. And when they're on lockdown, inmates are constantly complaining about the quality and the quantity even of the food. He had cancer, but they didn't diagnose him with the cancer until July, a month after he'd been approved for parole. But he was approved for parole and told he had to go through a six-month program. She understood why this program was needed. She didn't understand why these programs couldn't have been given to him any other time during his 18 years that he was in prison, or why he couldn't have come out and done the program on the outside.
And his loved ones told you he likely would have died anyway, but it would have been nice for him to die in a free world.
Yeah.
That's Texas Tribune prison reporter Jolie McCullough with an update on coronavirus and the Texas prison system. Jolie, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.
A group of self-described hillbillies in Kentucky has started the Rednecks for Black Lives movement, and they're urging others to re-examine some of their long-held beliefs.
The Confederate flag to us held a different meaning. We were told differently. We grew up that way. And it took me a while to admit the problem.
That's next time on Here and Now.